Well, welcome to our session on cultural differences. We're continuing from the last session in which we looked at how people communicate in Western culture. It's a very direct verbal communication, dependent upon words, either words spoken or words written. Whereas in the majority of the world, population-wise, the communication is usually less direct, more indirect. They use mediators, they use nonverbal communication, parables and stories, to, especially in stress situations, to communicate more effectively. And then when they get in conflict, the communication still changes even more. So let's turn to conflict for a few minutes, but maybe before we do that, as we've talked about these four values, cultural values, cultural differences. Do any of them resonate with Russian culture, with culture in this region of the world? Do you tend to be more Western or more majority world?
Yeah, that's interesting. We just talked and then in the break time. So, in Russia, truly between East and West. And it's funny sometimes we have this always diversity. Mm-hmm. And inside of Russia, not just somewhere, inside of Russia, different people say, okay, somebody came to the West, studied there, or lived there, say, okay, this is how the way, this is how we should do this. And the person came from the Russian person who's been in the West and came back and say, you all are on here, you have to start to do this new way. Yeah. And there's no other way to do it. So the other people say, no, you're wrong, you came from West, this is the only way to do it, we're doing all. So it seems like both of them are wrong. Mm-hmm. Because we're here in between this Asian and Western culture, and it seems like we have to be this kind of bilingual, bicultural people here to live in this position, situation in the world. So it seems the tendency to learn this course will be very needed here.
All right. Any other comments that things that came to your mind as you were listening to these differences?
Yes, as I was listening to the explanation of the differences between West and East, I thought of that classic example of cheating, how we perceive it, how Westerners perceive it. In Russia, it's almost like the whole group of students is up against the teacher who is going, you know, to be hard on them for not doing something. So they don't call it cheating, they call it mutual help, you know, support. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like a group effort. They want everyone to have their home assignment, whatever it takes. If it takes cheating, then it's cheating. But everyone's ready for the class, and that's perfect. I mean, the teacher is going to be happy. No one's going to get a bad grade and everything. And, you know, in the West, it's quite the opposite. I mean, it's that individualistic approach that you take. And if it's your assignment, it's your assignment. And you do it yourself, and everyone else does it individually. Mm-hmm. So that's probably one of the classic examples of the differences.
Yeah. It's very much that way in Africa as well. One group of students was asked to give their definition of cheating, and the African student stood up, as was custom in the British colonial days, and he said, "Sir, cheating is when one person withholds information another person has need of, sir," and he sat down. So sharing was a greater value, a more important value. And I think in many situations that is really a good value to have, because in sharing, maybe everybody can get better understanding. However, if in sharing answers with everybody, you get a high mark in medical school, but the student really isn't very good, but only gets high marks because of other help, will that physician be able to do the job? So I think in some situations it works, but in other situations where technological skill and knowledge is very important and life and death is there. Same for an airplane pilot. You don't want an airplane pilot who got through because Igor shared all the answers, and now I look very good and I pass the test, but I don't know what to do when I'm behind the controls of the airplane or in the surgery room. So, yes, I think times when sharing is good and we can help each other, other times when you have to prove your competence as an individual apart from anybody else because the risk is so great. All right. Anything else? Those are good comments.
As we look at the history, we can see that Russia is also tracing its philosophy and worldview origin from Greece and Rome. But it's Eastern development of Greece philosophy, while America is the most Western development.
Right.
That's why you see Western values taken to the age in the West, in the United States, and Eastern values, along with Greek values, taken to the age to the East in Russia. And you can see that deep inside, I can see that Russians more like Easterns, but outside and in behavior, more like Western. And Russian, of course, because of the globalization and trends, Russia is moving rapidly toward the West. The culture is drifting toward from the collectivistical values toward the individualistic values.
And I think many Americans who observe our culture carefully would say that our young people are moving much more towards collectivistic values. So the group becomes more important. Being together, learning together, we're losing our individualism. Let me just add one thing on the chalkboard here, because it's more a question than a statement. There's some, there's some thought that the Russian form of logic, not like this, not linear, or not what I would call sort of a narrative logic or a contextual logic. By the way, then there's also the what they call circular logic that goes like this, often found in Asia, and so on. But some authors think that there's a Slavic logic that would be true of Russia, and your thinking goes like this, and then there seems to be a bit of a gap, and it goes like that, and like that, and like that, and like that. And there, from a Western perspective, there seems to be gaps. But the gaps are filled in because you know the context, you know the way the person thinks or the way the thinking will go. And so they call this a Slavic form of logic. Does that seem accurate or not? Somewhat, yeah? Now, what's interesting is in the book, in the Bible, you have this form of logic when Paul writes to the Romans. Where did the Romans get their logic? The Greeks, absolutely. This is classic Greek logic if you read Pythagoras or any of the Greek scholars and their debates. This is very Jewish in its logic. So you read the book of Hebrews, who is Jesus Christ? He is greater than the angels. He's greater than Moses. His priesthood is superior to the priesthood of Aaron because his is after the eternal priesthood of Melchizedek. He's greater than any of the prophets, etc. And so you have Jesus Christ is greater, Jesus Christ is greater, Jesus Christ is superior, he's superior, he's superior. No matter how you look at it, he is superior. Therefore, the end of Hebrews, don't turn your back on Jesus. He's the same yesterday, today, forever. Don't go back to your Old Testament Jewish system. Jesus is the answer for everything. So that's the Hebraic. Here, you have the whole list of salvation, believing in Christ. If you don't believe in Christ, there's eternal death. Until you get to Romans 8:1, there is therefore. Classic way of coming to the conclusion. No condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus. Well, this you might find in some of the narratives. I'm not sure in the Bible, but I struggled with where one might find this logic in the Bible. And you know where I think it might be? In the book of Proverbs. The Proverbs, we see them as all individual little statements. But maybe for the culture, maybe they were a different kind of narrative. Maybe they're more linked together than we think. We see them as individuals. This proverb, this one's short, that one's longer, etc. But in the Russian form of logic, or at least the Slavic form of logic, maybe there's connections there. Anyway, for your thought, okay? So you have different kinds of logic that represents cultural difference. Now, I'll tell you what happens to me. When I go to Africa and I like my sermons or my speeches to be delivered this way and they deliver them this way, that's irritating to me. I get frustrated. I say, why do you have to keep saying the same thing over and over and over again? Well, first of all, they're a very narrative kind of culture. Only recently have they become a more literate culture. So everything had to be heard. The way people remember in hearing is if things are repeated again and again and again. So this is effective. Furthermore, I find that I remember this kind of sermon much longer than I remember this kind of sermon. So maybe it is a better way, at least as good. Okay? Well, let's continue then. And let's look at this issue of conflict. We're going to be taking a much closer look in future sessions, but I'll just mention it now. The way in which conflict is managed in the Western world is confrontation. See, this is what works with direct language. So if I'm a direct person and I have some kind of a problem with you, then I confront you with it. We even have a Bible verse in Matthew 18 that says, if a brother is taken in sin, go directly to the person, you know. So we think that's actually the best verse as far as a Westerner is concerned. And so confrontation. And then, of course, correcting is important. And avoiding, sometimes you avoid confrontation or you avoid conflict, particularly if you don't have any power. We'll talk more about that. And then there's something called passive-aggressive ways of handling conflict. It's a situation where you pretend not to be bothered or not to care about the conflict situation. So you say, no, I don't have any problem, no worries here. But deep down, you really do care. You feel strongly about certain things. And so on the surface, it looks smooth, but deep down, you care, you're concerned, you're actually starting to fight back, and you're doing things, but you're doing them carefully so you're not going to be caught or nobody can say you're doing this. So we call that, it appears that you're passive, that you don't care, but you're really aggressive underneath. And we're going to be talking more about that. That's a very difficult form of conflict, very difficult kind of person who is a passive-aggressive person. Very difficult to handle that. Well, most of the time, though, we say that this confrontation is the best way. That's the way we talk about it in the West. But in the majority world culture, we manage conflict through indirect methods. The mediator is the most common. And we'll come back and talk considerably more about that. But somebody who stands between, somebody who is objective, somebody who is fair. And if you take your concordance and you look at the word mediator in the Bible, you'll find it rather frequently in the Old Testament. Even today, people use mediators to arrange marriages, for example. We might call them something else, but they're mediating between the two parents for these children to be married. And then there's the use of story, as I told you earlier about this man who went to visit this fellow who was stealing from the church, or proverbs. For example, if a person is talking as though he's rather, you know, feeling good and proud about himself and telling how good he is and everything and how generous and wise, etc., we might in the West say, you know what, you're just sounding awfully arrogant right now. That's how we might deal with it. And the other person would, okay, you know, all right. They don't like it, but they accept it. But nobody would do that in Asia. They would say something like, the taller the bamboo grows, the more the top goes back to the ground. So it grows, and then it goes like that. The taller, the bigger the bamboo, the more humble it is. So you just say something like that, and the person hears it and stops the bragging and, you know, the self-inflation. So Proverbs are very important. Jesus often used stories in the New Testament, very Hebraic way of managing conflict. He used stories that were sometimes true, sometimes they were fictitious, but the story managed to often to avoid problems. Now, what was interesting is a lot of times the scribes and the Pharisees didn't understand the stories, and that made them angry because they knew that Jesus was talking about them. They just didn't know what he was saying exactly. So in Africa and in some other parts of the world, they say, if someone tells a story and you don't get it, it's probably meant for you. You see, because the story is intended to communicate something in an indirect way. So conflict is handled indirectly, and we're going to look more deeply at that because we deal with conflict so much in our cultures, in our across nations, in our families, in our businesses, and then friends sometimes experience conflict as well.
Even a small contribution can make a big difference. Jesus fed over 5,000 people because of a little boy's 5 loaves. Regardless of the amount, your contribution is very important and greatly appreciated. Visit us at www.tvseminary.com.
Well, how about, I use the word conduct here. In the West, an important part of conduct is to take responsibility, to be accountable. So you quite easily can say, I made a mistake. I'm responsible for what happened. I failed. I didn't do the job properly. We don't like people that refuse to take responsibility and to own up to the truth, to what actually happened. So one example of this could be Bill Clinton years ago when he fell into his situation with this woman and he denied it. And then it came out, of course, that there was a real situation there. But the American people were more angry at the fact that he lied than at the fact that he had this relationship with this woman. You see, telling the truth, we're back to that value again. Telling the truth is more important than many other things. So if you just tell us the truth, we can forgive you. But if you lie, if you try to deceive us, then we're going to hold that against you. Now, of course, time goes by and people forget and so on. So Mr. former President Clinton was a speaker at the recent big Democratic convention where President Obama would be renominated for the next president of America. So we forget these things. But at the time, the Americans were very upset. They were very upset at Richard Nixon because it appeared he lied with regard to some things that were going on during his administration. So take responsibility and admit it openly, and then we will forgive you. We won't be happy, but we'll say, okay, people make mistakes. We move on. Well, how does this work in other parts of the world? As I mentioned, in other societies, you have to save face. Avoid shame. protect your honor. So, Eunice, I think you wanted to know about Eunice. Was it? You wanted to know about Eunice. Okay. Eunice says, the dish fell from my hand and it is dead, or it has died. How do we understand this? Well, part of it is, there's a linguistic issue here, but part of that is that Eunice did not want to bring shame or loss of face upon herself. So she was trying to save face, save her honor, not be shamed by the mistake that she made. Now, part of that then is a number of things are going on all at the same time, so it gets to be a little bit complicated. For example, Eunice used the passive voice, it fell from my hand. In the West, we would use the active voice, I dropped the dish. Then she used the state of voice, it is dead, or it is in a state of being dead, it has died. Americans don't use the state of voice so much, but she did. So this is all confusing. Now, why did Eunice use the passive voice and the state of voice? Why didn't she use the active voice? Do you have any ideas as to why? Is the Russian language a more active voice or more passive voice language?
I think it's both.
Both. That would be interesting because that would agree with what Vitaly says, that mm-hmm. we're kind of both sides at the same time. Yeah. All right?
I guess Eunice didn't want to say that she did intentionally broken the dish. She wanted to stress that it happens by accident. Mm-hmm. So it's a big difference. It's not as much as her guilt because it just happened. She didn't want to do it.
You're quite right. It is a big difference. Mm-hmm. And you're exactly right. In Zulu, if you use the active voice, it implies intentionality. It implies that was you meant to do it. So when I said to Eunice, did you break the dish, what did she hear?
You're at fault. It's your fault.
You're at fault because you intentionally broke the dish. Go ahead and say it.
Yeah, she heard it. Is it your fault? Did you intentionally break the dish?
And of course, that was not correct.
And of course, that was not the case. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That was. So she used the passive voice, and in that context, that implies that it was an accident, that it was not intentional. And Africans anthropomorphize, that is, they give human life language to inanimate objects. So the dish, it died, you know, it's broken, it's died. Well, now that's interesting. Now I realize that if Eunice were to say to me, I broke the dish, she would have been saying in her mind, I intentionally did it, which would have been wrong. And so she was taking responsibility in her own way. It actually took me a year to find out why Eunice spoke that way. Most of my colleagues didn't know that. And I'm not sure they must have just accepted it somehow. I'm not sure. Eunice but sometimes would come back after she'd leave the house to catch the bus. She would come back and she would say, Mfundis, the bus left without me. And I'd say, Eunice, you mean you missed the bus? You were late for the bus? No, she says, no, it left without me. And I couldn't understand why she got so stiff, you know, no, because I was accusing her of intentionally missing the bus so she could get a ride home in the car or something. Well, you see, I'm making all of these negative judgments about Eunice, but I'm not understanding. When I understand what the active voice means in Zulu, then I say, oh, well, of course. Now I can understand properly and I'm not making negative judgments, not thinking negatively about people. So that's an important issue there, understanding why and how and what's happening here so that we don't make negative judgments about people and evaluate them in negative ways. Now, I want to talk about reality for a few minutes. This is quite important to us. One of the major differences from the majority world and the Western world is how we define reality. What is real? What is true? What is fact? What is accurate? And in the Western world, we emphasize the visible, the empirical, what we can see, what we can touch, what we can handle, what we can count, measure, and so that the tangible world is a very important part. In the majority world, the emphasis is more on the invisible, the spirit world, and on my experience that I'm having with the spirit world or with my relatives. And so there's actually three tiers of reality. For most of us, reality is here in the empirical world, that is, if we're in the West. So this is real, and this is real, and I can touch you, and you're real, and I can count. And so reality is a product of our senses, what we can see or touch or feel or measure. And we also have another reality. If you're a religious person, your reality is also heaven. And so for the Western person, they live here, and they live for the future, for heaven. These are two realities. But outside the West, there's another reality that's actually more important than either of these two. And Paul Hebert, an anthropologist who is a friend of mine, a wonderful person, lived in India for many years with his wife, died about 6-7 years ago, a tremendous loss to our seminary. He talks about the excluded middle because nobody in the West talks about it. Nobody in the West writes about it. We don't even think about it very much. But this excluded middle, and this is the spirit world, and it's the world of good spirits. And from a Christian standpoint, we would say things like angels, Holy Spirit. But there's also evil spirits. And there's another category, and I'm not sure how separate it is. It depends a little bit on the culture, but also ancestral spirits. So this spirit world is very active as far as the majority world people are concerned. Let me give you a series of illustrations because I think that's the best way to describe it in some detail. For example, architecture is determined by this middle world, this excluded middle. In Japan, and actually in many Asian restaurants, did you realize that you can't walk straight into the restaurant? You come into the door, and then you must either take a right or a left turn. The reason being that at night, the evil spirits come out and they follow people into the restaurant because they're looking for shelter, either from the rain or from the cold or something. So the evil spirits follow the people into the restaurant in the evening hours under darkness. And as the people come in, then the evil spirits can occupy that place, and they make trouble for the owner and for the people who are eating. Of course, that's not good for business. So if you put up a barrier, the barrier could be something like even a paper thing or some kind of a netting or a wall or even a painting. The evil spirits cannot make right or left turns. So they come straight in, they bump their head on this barrier, and then they must leave. See, even architecture is determined by your view of the spirit world. Okay? When do you sweep out your house if that's a job you have to do? Well, in India, you never sweep out your house after sunset, because if you hold the door open to sweep things out, which you do, and then sweep them off in the distance a bit, the evil spirits come in. while the door is open and you're holding it open to sweep. So you sweep out your house early in the morning or sometime midday, but not when it's dark. So even something as small and insignificant as sweeping out your house is dictated by that excluded middle world, your understanding of the spirit world, particularly evil spirits and ancestral spirits. Ancestral spirits can be good if you treat them right, bad if you don't treat them right. In China, your burial activity is determined by the spirit world. For the Chinese, the spirits occupy the high places on the ridges or the high hills or the mountains. And so the evil spirits are up there. So when you bury your relatives or friends or whoever, they are buried halfway down the hill. And then above the grave site is a gravestone. And it doesn't have to be very big, but it has to be there. And then below, if possible, there needs to be water. So when the people leave the ceremony, the evil spirits will come from the hilltops, and they'll come running down the hill quickly because they want to inhabit the body. But as they run down, they're running fast, and they trip over the headstone, and then they go rolling down the hill, and they enter out the water, and they drown. So now you protect the body from being bothered by evils. So now the burial is dictated, determined by your view of this excluded middle world. Well, in South Africa, the spirit world is very real. These evil gods, if you ever have seen a Hindu temple, usually it's decorated with hundreds of faces, carved faces on the outside, almost all of them looking very vicious, very angry. And among the Hindu, in the Hindu religion, which most of my students were, they came out of this situation where there were literally thousands of angry gods you had to please. And it would be the Hindu priest who would tell you which god you had to appease because of what you did wrong, so therefore you must do this. There is, of course, for Christians, the spirit world as a real world, not only Holy Spirit, but evil spirits who can do considerable disruption and create problems, like the demoniac in the New Testament who was occupied by demons and had no control over himself. So that is a real world for us. But in the West, not so much. But in Africa and in Asia, it's a very real part. And I have stories, but you'll get the idea here. Well, reality is seen differently depending on what part of the world you're in. Now, with Russia being influenced heavily by Western values and traditions, but also heavily influenced by Oriental values and traditions, how does this reality play out in your culture? Are both realities present, or is one more present than the others? Now, keep in mind that you're also coming out of a long term under communist era when the spirit world, God, doesn't exist, and the spirit world probably doesn't exist. So tell me what the situation is now.
I mean, in my opinion, it seems like the two cultures here. So you have all these spirits, and there's an old story from pagan time. There could be some kind of little, what they call a homi person, damavoy. It could be some spirit they live in. You have to please them in a certain way.
Okay.
At the same time, the person said, oh, yeah, I'm Christian. I believe in everything. And he believed in both things. Mm-hmm. So he would call the priest or something to sanctify the house or put some crosses or icons or some other symbols to chase the spirit. So that's the Christianity that has some kind of idea with kind of animistic or mm-hmm. thing that you fight with the spirit with another spiritual things. At the same time, I mean, you can find people like atheists who say no spirit, nothing, mm-hmm. anything, and we've been taught differently. They're very pragmatic, very rational, at least as much they can. So you can find both. So there's a great Orthodox church who would be here with all the you can sanctify the water, bring home and put it here. Mm-hmm. And then there's universities staying here all over, and people study the physics, math, and everything, and don't believe anything. So it seems, in my opinion, it's just a mix.
Yeah, both live parallel in the same society, and both are equally acceptable.
Sometimes you can have a person who would be university trained and believe in spirit, and and even in one person have two beliefs can be almost joined somehow in a certain way. It's hard to explain how. So, but
well, in closing, then. Thank you for that. Was there any other comment, anybody else's thought? I don't want to overlook. In closing, then, in the Western world, there tends to be the cultural value of openness, that is, being open and free in conversations, and truth. Openness and truth are foundational values. So a lot of what we talked about can be understood in the sense that we're right out there, and there's a truthfulness that we want, but also a direct, confrontational kind of approach. Open, direct. In the majority world, the core value is to maintain relationships or relational harmony and group cohesion, group solidarity. These are the two foundational pieces. So almost everything in the West is defined by this notion of we're open, and we talk, we're verbal. And in the other parts of the world, the majority world, there's the overriding concern for relational harmony. In the Philippines, they call it pakikisama, relational harmony, harmonious relationships. When I was in Japan speaking, they gave me the Japanese word. But again, I say, what's the most important value here? They say harmony among people. It's just so dominant, and pretty much the same in China, I think. By the way, I believe it's the, is it Cantonese that is also a passive voice language? I believe I'm not, one of the two is. And then, of course, this solidarity, not destroying the group, but keeping the group intact so that we have strength in numbers and we're together. Of course, there are many more cultural values. These are just certain ones that I point out that are, I think, essentially true of the West and the majority culture, but as you read, you'll find that there are many more cultural differences that exist. And as you get started and enter into another culture, you'll discover what they are. But maybe these will be helpful as a start. The point being is that they're cultural differences. They're not cultural rights and wrongs. So we need to develop this category of differences when we're changing cultures, moving into other cultures. But when we're moving into the culture of marriage, we also need to understand that so much of what happens is different, not wrong. And if we put it in the category of wrong, it's going to cause us conflict. When we enter into a job or a friendship or a new kind of situation, most of what's going on there is different, not right or wrong. And so we need to operate. There are some things that are right, some things that are wrong. But much of our life is in this category of differences. And if we can function with that category, it will make things much more smooth, much more harmonious for all of us. And that's the end of this session.
Now he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will also supply and increase your store of seed and will enlarge the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in every way so that you can be generous on every occasion. And through us, your generosity will result in thanksgiving to God. 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 10-11. How to give to TVS Ministry. You may give online at efta.org/givenow. In the description place, write Russia Distance Learning, account number 24109-0150. Or make checks out to EFCA. Write on the check memo line, Russian Distance Learning, account number 24109-0150. Mail to EFCA Donor Services, 901 East 78th Street, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55420-1300. Or send your gift through PayPal for tvs.gift@gmail.com.